So what happened, huh? Hey, wait a minute. I know. You're working for little Bo Peep. She's lost a sheep, and you're gonna help her find him.
Get this straight, Meatball. I don't work for Jones.
So what's his problem?
Toon killed his brother. Dropped the piano on his head.
Remember me, Eddie?
When I kill your brother, I talk just with me!
Hello and welcome to episode 97 of Unfunny Nerd Tangent. My name is Greg, aka your Captain Boomerang, putting on my best monkey suit to write this show in the famous disappearing, reappearing ink as we dive deep into one of the most classic movies that's been around for over 30 years now, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Joining me today, all the way from Toontown, our first panelist has the only spare, but I don't think you want it. He also prefers his scotch on the rocks, and while we might never know who he really is, one thing's for sure. He ain't no rabbit, or a duck, or a dog, or a little wooden boy. Anyway, that's because he's the super Jew, Jared Rabinowitz.
It's bourbon, not scotch. I'm a bourbon guy. I've told you this before. Come on.
tell it to the penguins. All right. Also joining us today, he only agreed to come on the show if his character was given equal screen time to Jared's. We'll never forget him with his burning red eyes, his high-pitched squeaky voice, and love of Suicide Squad. When he's looking for a good time, he calls Alice in Wonderland, and one of these days, he's going to die laughing, probably during the tick. From attackofthedad.com, he's Tim Hockney.
I am bad, and I am also drawn badly.
Yeah, it's the watercolors. Yeah. And finally, giving up his tawdry nightclub patty cake antics for one day, returning to the show after appearing on our Metallica episode, we got him on loan from Disney, and the best part is he works for Peanuts. From the Mike Seibert Radio Podcast, he's Mike Seibert.
Well, tell you what, is that a rabbit in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
Oh, a little column A and a little column B.
There it is. Thanks for having me back.
No worries. Thanks for being back on. So, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was released way back in 1988, which Jared was probably just a gleam in someone's eye at that point.
I was two. One and a half, but...
Well. He was already smoking cigars, though.
Yeah. But looking back now, it's probably the first ever, like, crossover event I can kind of remember as a kid, because... like, all the hype was about this movie. Not only the fact that it had Disney and Warner Brothers characters in the same movie, but all the groundbreaking special effects that went into creating this mix of a cartoon world and the real world. And, I mean, I think they made, like, about a dozen behind-the-scenes specials for this one, showing all the, you know, the rigs and all that kind of stuff, and I pretty much watched them all. So... then we went to the movie to see it, and, I mean, it blew my mind. So, I mean, like we said, Jared, you were only just smoking cigars at that point. But, Tim, you were only a little bit younger than me. So, like, how did you first see this movie? Did you see it in the theaters like I did?
I did see it in the theaters. And the thing that I remember, what sealed it for me, the reason I absolutely had to see it in theaters – was there was a TV spot for Roger Rabbit that had that Yosemite Sam bit in it when he jumps up in the air and screams, "My biscuits are burning," and this to me was the funniest thing I had ever seen on television at that point, and I was all in on this movie. And then I saw it, and it super gave me nightmares. I was really freaked out by the ending.
And Mike, we're pretty much the same age, I think. You might have me by a year or two, I think.
I think it just depends on where our birthdays hit. It's like sometimes it overlaps depending. But I think we're currently the same age, maybe. Yeah. But I saw Roger Rabbit in the theaters when I was 9 years old. So this was like, you know, a year before Batman. And, you know, I had an aunt and uncle that took me to the movies all the time. And I remember this screening very explicitly because we got there a little bit late. And I think it was opening weekend or at some point when the theater was packed. And I want to say it was one of my first experiences going to a packed theater and then like trying to navigate through trying to find seats. We ended up sitting like way up front, and I remember being just literally blown away by everything in this movie, you know. And you know, like Tim was saying, I mean, there's no shortage of nightmare fuel in this movie as well. But it was like it ticks all the boxes, you know. It's hilarious, but it's also pretty scary as well. And I think one of the questions that we'll have to tackle as we go through this journey here is, who is this movie for? Because like as I was watching it just the other night, I've watched this movie for years, you know, for 30 years. And, you know, it wasn't until getting ready for this show with you guys that I was like, wait a second. There's so much adult content here. I don't know who this is for.
Yeah, it's definitely it does straddle that line quite a bit. It's like, hang on a sec, what? But then on the other hand, okay. So like Jared, when you did finally see this movie, I'm guessing how old would you have been then? Did you sort of see it as like a kid, like 5 or 6 or 10, or when did you see it?
No, I think I saw it not that long after it made a home video release. Like I remember being very young and liking this movie and watching it. And it was kind of right around, I want to say it was probably late 89, early 90 when I finally saw it. You know, because I remember I was in that like 4-year-old range right about. So because I remember it was kind of like that and Dick Tracy. Oh, yeah. I remember having the Dick Tracy watch with the disappearing ink and the little hand buzzer from this. So I don't remember like the sequence of events of when I saw it or anything like that, because, you know, 3 or 4 years old. But I remember having the VHS and watching it and all that.
Dick Tracy was actually one of the movies that released in theaters with a Roger Rabbit short. Roller Coaster Rabbit, I think, was at least in the U.S. Aired before Dick Tracy.
Mm-hmm. I remember that we got, I can't remember if it was Dick Tracy or not, but I do remember seeing that cartoon in front of a movie and I was like, oh, okay, they're doing this now. Like they're doing, you know, they're using Roger Rabbit like a normal character again, sort of thing.
Dick Tracy did release after Roger Rabbit.
That's what I mean. So like when it must've been that movie then, cause I remember I saw Dick Tracy at the cinema as well. Yeah,
there were three shorts that they did, and they were all kind of big budget and really nicely done. They all ended with like actual live action footage of Roger, you know, in the studio with real directors and stuff like that, just like what we see in the opening sequence of Roger Rabbit. But it was Tummy Trouble, which aired with Honey I Shrunk the Kids, Roller Coaster Rabbit with Dick Tracy.
Maybe it was that one.
And then another one called Trail Mix Up, which I don't remember seeing that one in theaters. And this says it aired with A Far Off Place, but also with Treasure Planet. Some of them aired with like multiple Disney releases.
Mm. Yeah. Judging by the timeline,
that's like late 90s though. Weird.
Yeah. No, 2002.
Oh Jesus. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there was a lot of, I mean, we can get into it later, but there was a lot of talk of like sequels and things like that sort of popped up here and there. So they probably thought, oh, we'll just do a short and see how it's kind of judged. And if people start crying out for a movie, maybe we'll make one. But they didn't. Yeah. So,
judging by the timeline, there's a strong chance that the reason why I ended up watching Roger Rabbit was seeing it in front of Dick Tracy.
Yeah, like maybe.
That's actually very in the realm of possibility given the timeline, because Dick Tracy would have been out right around my 4th birthday.
Mm. See, I always remember, it's funny, with Dick Tracy, like, if we go on a Dick Tracy tangent, it's that movie to me, that I always point to Dick Tracy as, like, that's the dividing line of Pacino. That's where he went from young, sort of soft-spoken, nasally Pacino to, like, ooh-ah, and all that shit that he does now. Because, like, Dick Tracy, where he's a big boy, he has the sort of the gravelly voice, and he seems like he sort of forgot how to not do that voice, and then that's Al Pacino from now on. So yeah, to me, it's always pre Dick Tracy and post Dick Tracy, Al Pacino. So, but yeah, but like I said, like this movie, you have to remember it was all pre CGI effects, and everything's practical to make it seem like there are cartoons running around with human beings, and I mean, really, they put so much detail into it. I mean, the standout one I think that most people go to is when Roger is hiding beneath Eddie's coat, and also like the octopus bartender, where there's just mm-hmm. bottles and shot glasses and he's wiping the counter and all that kind of stuff. Was there any kind of, like having watched it again now, obviously for the show, does anything sort of stand out to anyone as a particular highlight with the tunes in the real world effects, or even any lowlights of like, oh, that didn't quite work?
I think the highlight has to be the stuff with Betty the Cab.
Like, oh, yeah. Yep.
When they're traveling like that, I think that is probably one of the more dynamic interactions that occurs that was probably harder to pull off. And it still, you know, it looks good. Now, I will say I watched this on Disney Plus yesterday. And so that is it's not 4K, but it is Dolby Vision HDR. And so I don't know if they did any editing stuff, like, you know, if they went full George Lucas on it to smooth stuff out, or if it was just a color accuracy thing that they did to fit the Dolby Vision. And I'm sure Tim knows all about this, but I thought that still looked pretty good, you know, even by comparison to today's stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not just up converted from the 2013 Blu-ray then? They did clean it up then?
I don't know that. Tim, this seems to be your area of knowing what is and isn't 4K and HDR and all that stuff. So
Tim has the Steelbook. Yeah.
I dropped the ball on this one. Well, yeah, I don't have the Steelbook. I just have the Disney Plus version. But with a lot of these things that come out on Disney Plus, the Star Wars movies are probably the most famous example. You can't I guess maybe you can buy the Star Wars movies in 4K now, but when Disney Plus launched, you couldn't. Like, that was the first place you could see them in 4K. But I don't know exactly what they did with Roger Rabbit. I know Disney has been kind of slammed for some of their Blu-ray conversions. Like, the Blu-rays of their classic movies look really good, but people complain about colors being different, about certain details being lost. And sometimes the Blu-ray releases compare kind of unfavorably with the DVDs. But I haven't done any kind of a deep dive on Roger Rabbit to know for sure what they did or didn't do for the HDR transfer.
Yeah. So one of those things that it's saying that it's 4K, but I don't think it in the Disney Plus, and I'm trying to check it now, in the Disney Plus little thing where it tells you if it's 4K, if it showed that or not, because I don't think it did. And it just said HDR, but yeah, the Dolby Vision. So
it's probably one of those things where, like, the more detail you give it, the like it might actually make it worse, because the 2D animation and things like that become sort of super grainy, and it might almost like make it appear as though, like, look, you can really tell they're not there now because of so much detail. Whereas, like, the sort of the quality of viewing and home video and things like that in the 80s and 90s, it kind of hid a lot of that stuff. You know, where you might be sort of like, oh, I see, you can almost see this part or that part. But I mean, rewatching it, I didn't sort of notice anything stand out to be like, oh, okay, I thought it looked good as a kid, but wow, that looks really fake now. But like, it looked just seamless as well that I could, you know, see.
Well, I think there was kind of like a Vaseline softness, you know, to the overall cinematography to kind of help blend the softer animation with the live action. And yeah, I wonder if they do a full 4K transfer, if that crispness would actually kind of ruin it. But I guess a couple highlights and lowlights for me. It's really subtle, but like when they're in the back of the bar and Eddie keeps knocking his head on the lamp, and how the lighting changes as the lamp just sways from side to side. And I mean, just to be able to match that in animation was, and it's just like the most subtle thing. They didn't have to do that. You know, they did enough technological technologically marveling stuff that, you know, they probably just could have let that go and it'd be fine. But what I, one of the weird lowlights for me, and I think this always bugged me when I was a kid, like in particular when Eddie gets thrown out of the club, you know, that throw doesn't quite look right. I'm not picking nits, but in one where, like, if I have to pick something to where it's like, when I watched it the other day, I felt the same way about it as I did like other times I've watched it when I was significantly younger. I'm like, that's the one. I don't know if it's just the way like his jacket gets pulled or something. There's something just not quite right there. It almost throws you out.
The only one I noticed where I was like, oh, hang on, was at the very start, like when what's his name? Raul, you know, the director. And he's like, you can't see stars. Like it says stars, all this kind of stuff to Roger. And he's like, I can do it. And he's, the director's walking away and Roger grabs the sleeve of his coat to pull him back and be like, wait. He does it once and then he does it a second time. And I can't remember, it's either the first or the second where like the coat sort of lifts up to his hand. He doesn't quite grab it. He kind of like Jedi's it almost. It's like, it's only just a little subtle thing. And I was like, oh, okay. But I mean, again, that's, you're not going to be like, oh, fuck, they failed. But I mean, that's the only one I could think of, like, of sort of thinking like, oh, okay, you can kind of see the trick there. But yeah, all in all, I mean, I think they did a pretty amazing job considering, like we said, it's over 30 years ago that, and just little things like when Roger's in what is it, Arcane Maroon in his office, but just before they give him the first drink, you know, and he goes nuts, like just little things. He's walking around the office and he's bumping a chair and he jumps up on the desk and there's just little rattles of desks and the chair swings just a little bit, things like that, which like you don't sort of think about, but it's like someone had to make all that happen because he's not there. So yeah, it's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, they could have made this movie with a lot of still shots. I just watched the making of documentary that's on Disney Plus, and they talk a lot about how in animation there's not a lot of camera moves, and the movie the camera moves quite a bit, and there's all that little stuff that you said going on in the scene, and you're right, they didn't have to do it, but the fact that they did it, the fact that Roger is puttering around this room knocking things over, it's what makes it, it's what really sells it. That the combination of all those little effects and all those little extra bits, and then also I think Bob Hoskins, the way, just his acting and the way that he reacts, and that making of feature actually features him, you know, very prominently a lot too. And it's incredible if you haven't heard him talk in his real voice, like, oh my God.
Like, oh yeah.
He's English? Like what?
Yeah, he's very English.
He's this extremely British, like Shakespearean actor. And I could have sworn he was from New York.
Oh yeah. Nope. Yeah. But before we get to Bob Hoskins, because I do want to talk about him, because yeah, we can't really praise him enough. I just wondered like how you thought, like Tim, while I've got you, that the opening cartoon, because we spoke about those shorts before with Dick Tracy and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or whatever, the opening of the movie starts with the cartoon, and that's that real kind of like Tex Avery, Tom and Jerry kind of thing. But that's how I remembered it anyway, with, because you only see the lady's legs and things like that. That was a bit of a Tom and Jerry thing. Do you like that the movie starts with the cartoon before it cuts to the reality of the real world, and you see that it's all taking place on a soundstage or a movie set?
Yeah, and another thing they mentioned in this documentary was how in like the earliest test screenings, people were like walking out. They were like, well, like this isn't the movie that was supposed to watch. Like I'm leaving. Like they didn't understand or they didn't get the cartoon initially, and were kind of like, they just checked out. They didn't like the idea that it opened with a cartoon, but I think it's really the perfect way to do it. And Zemeckis really fought to kind of keep that opening in the movie. And it really like, it sets the scene well. Like we understand who Roger Rabbit is, and we get the kind of cartoon partnership, Roger Rabbit being this sort of like unwilling babysitter for baby Herman who's just constantly getting into trouble. And is there really like another cartoon duo that has that same kind of dynamic? I mean, because you've got your Tom and Jerry's and your Sylvester and Tweety. Typically, it's like a, you know, like one animal trying to eat another animal.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It feels like that. Like I feel as though there is, but I'm struggling to think of it. Maybe it's just because of this movie. But I feel that there is.
Is it somewhere in the Tom and Jerry universe? There's a set of characters like that, maybe, or.
Yeah, I feel that there's like it's not the sheepdog and you know like Morning Ralph, Morning whatever the other one is. It's not that, but I feel like it's something like that, like one of those Warner Brothers cartoons that's not like it's not Bugs Bunny, it's not Sylvester. It's like this is the one with just some random in it. But
they had one. I feel like an Animaniacs even. I think it might have just been a little baby.
It could be in that,
But of course, Animaniacs was post Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
It was Buttons and Mindy in Animaniacs, with the dog that's always trying to protect the little girl who's like wandering off and getting into trouble all the time.
That might be it. Yeah.
But that's. But I feel like that's based on an older cartoon trope. Mm. I just can't think of who the characters were.
I mean, there's a lot of those sorts of cartoons that weren't really Warner Brothers or Disney or anything. You know, like they just. Here's a cartoon, kids, and you're like, who is this? Oh, this is something that was made and then they went out of business in the 40s or something. There's like a lot of those that you would see as a kid and just be like, all right. But it's just, I think what I liked about the opening of it is you see the cartoon and you sort of get to know Roger, even though he's meant to be playing the character of Roger Rabbit and all this. But it sort of, very subtly sets up the more adult nature of some of the things to come. And the thing that stands out to me is like that one part where all the knives get thrown or catapulted at Roger, you know, and you get the big eyes and they all sort of go, fum, 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 you know, around him. The last one is the cleaver and it almost hits him in the nuts. And he reacts like, ooh, that nearly hit me in the nuts. And so it's not like your normal like kids cartoon thing. And it's like, okay. So like from there, I think then you get to go on with it, like with some of the more adult stuff and things like that. But I mean, the movie never goes overboard with that kind of thing, or I don't think it does, but there is still a lot of adult stuff in it. I mean, released as a straight up Disney movie. It was a Touchstone movie because that was their kind of like,
adult brand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ooh, it's Disney, but it's not Disney. Shh, don't tell anybody. Maybe nobody will notice.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think...
you're fooling nobody.
Yeah. 3 Men and a Baby, I think, was Touchstone as well. So, like, that kind of thing, you know?
It was one of those things that I was looking at this last night. One of the reasons for doing Touchstone is they were concerned that, like, if kids saw, like, Disney logos on this stuff, that it might put parents in like a harder situation to say no. Like it was one of those, they didn't want to, it wasn't so much for adults to confuse them. It was for adults to deal with the children so that they could have that kind of mature.
Like, why can't I see it? It's a Disney movie type of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But then, I mean, Disney movies have never shied away from some of that shit, like Bambi and fucking Dumbo and all this stuff. Like, Jesus, like that's some of the most fucked up shit that people saw as a kid. And, you know, people were scared of you know, Disney villains and things like that, it's consistent. But I think it's not as much of an ambush as like something like the Transformers movie, Mike, where it was just like,
that's actually your friends. That's where I was kind of going with that, because let's not forget that most of those Disney movies that you just mentioned, Greg, like, you know, your Bambis, your Dumbos and whatever, those are all G-rated fare. This is PG, you know, not all that dissimilar to say like a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or, you know, some of the other, you know, less full on animated Disney movies. You know, Disney cartoons were not PG. It's not until yes, of course, 1986's seminal, the Transformers, the movie, where you start getting into PG rated cartoons with, like, you know, actual stakes and swearing and violence and heavy metal prog rock and synth wave. And I'm getting wrapped up in my affection for Transformers here, but no, I think you guys are all absolutely right in that there's something about, like, the Disney brand, and that it's a, you know, canonical Disney movie, where that would just be a difficult conversation to be like, well, why can't I watch this? Well, because it has, you know, it's live action, and, you know, and it's got all this adult content, but it's Disney, you know. And I don't think the mouse at that point was ready for that type of content in animation. And in fact, I guess I'd have to think on this more, but I would almost think it's probably not until we're getting to, like, maybe, oh, I don't know, maybe Lion King, something like that, maybe kind of the rest of that golden age, where we're starting to kind of push the envelope a little bit. But I think Lion King is still rated G. I don't know what the first PG rated straight up Disney canon movie is. I might have to look that up while we're chatting amongst ourselves, but I think that's the distinction. And I think that's why it's under the Touchstone banner.
Yeah, I just think they didn't want Jessica Rabbit to be a Disney princess. I think that was the key thing there.
Great point. Yeah.
They didn't do a Happy Meal. Like, I was for some reason, I could have sworn they did. There was a huge Dick Tracy promotion at McDonald's with all these little scratch off games, but I don't think that was really aimed at kids. I don't know. Maybe it was, but for Roger Rabbit, there was no Happy Meal, and he doesn't show up in Happy Meal toys until, like, 1994. They did these Disneyland Adventures Happy Meals, and there's a little Roger Rabbit Benny the Cab thing.
So yeah, it's
not
like,
not like a Batman Returns situation where they,
yeah, they're gonna have, it's not Reverse Flash, Tim. your Reverse Flash death from Flashpoint Paradox with your son.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, Daddy, there's a hole in his head. Yep. Shit. So they didn't go that far with it. But, I mean, the post-Roger cartoon sequence sets up a lot as well, like how the Toons are basically actors, and they have the same issues that real actors have. They flub their lines and all that. Like we said, Roger can't see stars. He can see everything else. But then... he's not in it much, but he is sort of the most, one of the more memorable characters. And, like, Jared, we said before about you smoking cigars like Baby Herman, but I figure you would like that character as well, just for what it is.
Baby Herman?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Baby Herman was pretty funny. Also, you know, the going for the cookies on top of the jar, on top of the fridge. That's definitely something I could see happening for me, you know.
You'd like a sexy woman to push you around in a pram too, I imagine. That wouldn't be too far out of your wheelhouse.
That's my retirement plan.
I think Baby Herman's in the movie just enough, to be honest. Yeah. Like, I think he's in it a little bit here and there, and then, yeah, I think if it was the Roger and Baby Herman show, I think it might sort of get a bit much. Well, you'd sort of run out of jokes.
Baby Herman is a savory spice. Got to be used in moderation.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's a lot of world building in the background early on as well. I mean, they do kind of, or throughout the movie, but, like, I like that they set up Goofy as this kind of Peter Sellers type comedic genius in this world, and people are sort of like, oh yeah, Goofy, oh, he's the best, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then you only see him at the end, but and, like, the Toon Ticks, as I call them, where, like, the, you know, shaving a haircut, that joke sort of thing, where Doom sort of drags him out, and, like, the whole you do, I don't, all that sort of rabbit season, duck season, that kind of shit. So that I thought that they did a good job of having, like, you saw the world that you haven't seen before, but it felt familiar because you knew all the tropes of the cartoons. So I just wondered if that sort of helped you guys, like, when you're watching this movie, mostly with, like, the character of Roger, and because he was a new character at the time. So do you think that sort of helped integrate him into the movie, so you didn't have to think, oh, who's this guy?
Yeah, I'll kind of go. I'm already branching off here on my own tangent. I think that not only does it set that up, but also, like, it gives us like a little entree into the more adult themes. Like you already kind of offhandedly mentioned the throwaway joke with, you know, Dumbo, he works for peanuts, but you know, these cartoons aren't just regular actors. They are cheap labor for the Hollywood studios, and they're sort of being exploited, and they sort of have like not a lot of ownership, not a lot of voice in what's going on and how they're being treated. So Roger's out there like working, putting himself in real danger, and then just getting shit on because he couldn't see stars.
Well, they work for Disney.
Yeah. but the theme is it winds up being like, you're very resonant today, as we're having these conversations about like, why don't we have more women and minority ownership in professional sports, things like that. You know, it's just like, I don't even know. It's not, the thread isn't even pulled all that much in Roger Rabbit, but it is, you know, part of what the movie wants us to do is to see the humanity in the cartoons, right?
Yeah, it's definitely there. In fact, I think I'll even push that one further. There's almost an underpinning of racism there, you know, and certainly classism, because, yeah, I mean, the Toons are really kind of regarded as second class citizens outside of Toontown.
Yeah, and Toontown is sort of like a ghetto that is set to be gentrified. Yeah. Like, that's what the movie is about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Doom wants to, at the end, essentially get rid of Toontown. So I guess, is that some kind of genocide reference as well? I don't know. Like, there's a lot going on. But yeah, do you like Roger in general? I mean, like, to me, I think the movie does a good job of sort of just showing his antics and personality. But I mean, I see a lot of criticisms. I think they're modern criticisms, to be honest, where like, oh, he's annoying and things like that. But like, to me, it's like, no, like, I'm not annoyed. But it's like I'm not laughing at that character, I'm laughing with that character, that sort of thing. It's like, I'm not annoyed by Roger, I'm annoyed with, like, alongside Eddie, because Eddie's annoyed and you're meant to be, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't know, what do you guys think about, like, Roger being Roger? Is he like Jar Jar Binks is the one that comes up all the time. It's like, oh, he's like Jar Jar Binks. It's like, well, maybe if you saw that first.
I never thought of that.
I don't see that as the same. I don't think Roger is Jar Jar. I don't think that's the. I don't think that's a fair equivalent there, because I think Roger, it's more personality. It's definitely more of a focus and definitely less annoying.
Yeah.
Roger's kind of more along the lines of that, like, strung out nerd who got a chick who's way too hot for him, than just an annoying Jar Jar.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with the Jar Jar thing. I just mean, like, that's where I've seen people like, oh, he's like, I hadn't seen it before, I watched it, and he's annoying, he's like Jar Jar Binks. It's like, I think, like, you're meant to be frustrated and kind of annoyed by Roger, but not at the character. Like, you're meant to be annoyed sort of with him and frustrated, because it's like, oh, Eddie's trying to get you to go here and do this, and he's jumping around singing songs, and it's like, what are you doing? So I think that's sort of... That's the way I see it. But, I mean, I don't find him annoying at all. I just thought, yeah, it does. I mean,
Roger also has – he's got, like, real motivation that we can identify with. And you know, we see him at work. We see him doing his job. But then in that scene where Eddie's yelling at him for making a big racket in the bar, you know, Roger, he's just talking about how these men needed to laugh. You know, like, he really believes in what he's doing. And so there's not just the emotional stakes of, you know, the stuff that's going on with his marriage and that he's in, like, all this trouble that he's been framed for murder. But we also have, you know, just there's a real emotional connection between him and his own goofiness that we can understand and sort of relate to. And you think about Jar Jar Binks, like, does he have a motivation? Is there any reason for him to do any of the things that he does in that movie besides, like, Liam Neeson kind of strong-arming him?
Yeah, he just kind of he's just kind of there.
Yeah, like, he really is.
Well, and go ahead.
I was going to say, the other thing with Jar Jar is it's kind of, or not Jar Jar, with Roger, okay, is he's under the protection there, and we've seen so many of those cop gets annoyed by the prisoner or witness he's trying to protect type thing, and that's kind of almost a movie trope at this point.
It's very Midnight Run is a good example of that.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. So I'm trying to think of a good example.
Oh, you'd like that, actually, Jared.
I think it's Joe Pesci in Lethal Weapon is kind of what I'm thinking there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's a good point. See, like, Joe Pesci's character, what did he, Leo Getz? Like, he's an annoying guy, but you don't, he's not annoying to watch. Like, that's the way I sort of see it. Same with Roger. Like, if you were around Roger in real life, you'd be like, fuck. Like, you know, but the movie, it's like, that's what you meant. You're meant to, it's meant to stir up Eddie because he already has this, like, prejudice against the Toons and stuff like that. And it helps Eddie's arc. And like you said, Tim, like, this is 1947, so the war's over. People are coming back to work. There's packed back from the war. There's not as much work. Like, you see that early on in the transit bar with the guy, you know, he gets laid off and there's, you know, there's the return. There's the guy, the serviceman. He's got, like, one arm missing, all that kind of stuff. And like, it's pretty depressing, the world that they're in there. So... And Roger's whole thing about, like, the power of laughter and all this, there's that moment there where that works, because that Angelo guy, like, doesn't turn him in to Doom because he made him laugh. And later on, when Eddie even says to Jessica, like, well, why are you with Roger Rabbit, you know, and she's like, he makes me laugh. And you're like, yeah, there you go. So, like, it's sort of this theme going through it as well. So make people laugh and they won't turn on you and you can get – Jessica, I don't know.
Well,
even if you're a rabbit.
I think the thing of it also is that Roger is an actual character. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got foibles. He's got flaws. You know, he's got motivation and character depth, like we were just saying. You know, whereas some of these other examples of annoying characters are really kind of one-dimensional, whereas Roger is incredibly endearing and definitely multifaceted as a fleshed-out character.
Yeah, and he's even got, like, you can be sympathetic to the idea he's freaking out because kind of his professional life is difficult with work and what's going on with the baby Herman and stuff. And then he's got the concern that his wife's cheating on him, or girlfriend, or is it wife? I'm blanking right now.
His wife.
So, like, that is something that can be sympathetic. So it's you're right. There is depth to the character.
Yeah, and every guy that's punching above his weight with, like, a hot girlfriend, like a wife, they are probably always constantly on the edge of just, like, she's too good for me, she's gonna leave, you know. So his character motivations are very, like, realistic, I think. And, like, even early on when you think. He doesn't kill Acme, because the whole movie is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, like, so straight away. But, like, the scenes that you see before that, you could, it is believable that he did go and kill him, just because of the, we've seen him as the happy-go-lucky rabbit, but you see him get fired up too. When Eddie says, you know, you can just pick up another girl or whatever, and he sort of jumps up on him and he's like, she's the only one for me, and he's all fired up and he smashes through the window. So he does have genuine rage there, which is you know, not something you would necessarily you know, match up with something like Roger Rabbit. So but we get introduced to Eddie Valiant pretty early on, and then, I mean, that's what I want to talk about with Bob Hoskins, everyone's favorite Mario brother. But
top two, at least.
Yeah, Mario. I mean, I can't praise him enough for this movie. I mean, he's, like we said, he's all by himself for most of the movie, but he sells that Roger is there. And I mean, like, the handcuff joke, for instance, you know, like, his eye line is pretty much perfect in every scene he's in, and he's following Roger around, and he looks away and comes back, and it's still, he's back to where he should be looking. It's not just sort of looking through to nothing, or you know, obviously he's on a big, or as if he was on a big green screen kind of thing. Which, so I mean, I don't know, this performance by Hoskins, I mean, it gets a lot of praise, but I still think it's underrated.
Yeah, definitely. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, definitely. And one of the things that occurred to me, I mean, obviously, Mr. Hoskins has since passed, RIP. But I kind of felt a weird sadness that he didn't just blow up after this. You know, it's like, you know, he shows up in Mario Brothers. He shows up in Hook. You know, he shows up in like a couple of other, I mean, he remained a character actor, you know, throughout the remainder of his career. And on my most recent watching of Roger Rabbit, I felt kind of sad about that because he carries this entire movie on his shoulders and he's brilliant.
Yeah, I think if anything, this might have even like pigeonholed him into being like, oh, he's the guy from the family kids movies type of thing. And he was like, no, I don't really want to do that. So I think maybe he would have got more, like he could have done more sort of this type of thing, but I don't think he really particularly wanted to.
He was,
it's a lot of work.
He was in Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties.
Nice. And the Spice Girls movie. Don't forget that.
Yeah.
He didn't have to travel for that one.
I don't know what it says about me that I've seen Spice World, but not Garfield : A Tale of Two Kitties.
I think if you're going to see one of those two movies, Spice World is probably the way to go.
Jeez.
That was at least like culturally relevant in its day.
Fair.
That is about the nicest thing you can say about that movie.
I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know. I have seen the Wannabe video. If you go back and rewatch the Wannabe video, what I will say about the Wannabe video is that Mel B carries the whole thing. The rest of the Spice Girls are useless.
Yeah. There's a show, Tim. Who's your favorite Spice Girl?
If you want to talk about, you know, marrying up and out of your league, you know, some of the Spice Girls ended up doing that. One's married to a team lead for Formula One. The other one married and divorced or got knocked up by Eddie Murphy. You got another one who married David Beckham. You know, they didn't do too bad for themselves.
I still remember. Are you guys familiar with Ali G? You know, Sacha Baron Cohen? Yeah. I know because you know you guys know Borat and all that, but I wasn't sure. I remember he had one of his interviews and like, oh, it was all out by then. Everybody knew that it was, you know, it wasn't the gotcha style interview that he kind of did early on, but it was Ali G and, David Beckham and Victoria Beckham. And he's talking to him and he's like, all right. So like Victoria Beckham's sitting right there. He says to David Beckham, so like, all right, just between you and me, in a perfect world, you'd really be with baby, right? They both just crack up, and like to be fair, she was laughing at it, and it was all, you know, in fun. But like just the way he said it, I was like, "Holy shit!" Yeah.
He's right though. You don't get to choose your Spice Girl; your Spice Girl chooses you.
That's it. You got to get with their friends, Tim.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and time has not been kind to Baby Spice. By the way, look more like Old Spice nowadays.
No,
I'm on a horse.
There it is.
But yeah, I think this movie, like we spoke before about how it blurs the line between being like this family film and this sort of dark sort of noir story and things like that. But like, I think Eddie is the key to it because like his hatred of Toons is fleshed out with his temper and his lack of sense of humor and all that kind of stuff. But like you get that explanation in this little scene where you have this mix of grim seriousness and then comedy at the same time, because he fires up at Angelo and he's like, I don't work for Toons, you know? And it's like, well, what's his problem? And Dolores is like, oh, Toon killed his brother. And you're like, oh, that's terrible. And then the very next line is, dropped a piano on his head. And you go, oh, that's funny.
It's amazing. So,
I just wonder, like, Tim, you often watch stuff with your kid. Like, how do you think, has your kid seen this? Or how would he sort of react to some of this stuff?
Yeah, so actually, like, a couple of weeks before we decided to even do this episode, thanks to all of our Twitter followers who voted in the poll, by the way. I actually sat down and watched it with him just because I don't know why. It just popped up on Disney Plus, I guess, and he was curious about it. And I kind of wanted to watch it again, and it just seemed like kind of a good thing to put on a Saturday. I've been, you know, as part of this quarantine, trying to, like, trying to get him into some of these classic movies that I watched when I was a kid. Like, we just finished like the original Indiana Jones trilogy. So you know, if we can like once a week, like sit down and watch a movie that was important to me growing up, I think that's pretty cool. And so, the whole family kind of got together to watch Roger Rabbit. And I think it works because some of the darker stuff is kind of over the kids' heads. Like, you don't see Eddie's alcoholism quite so much, right? Like, a line like "dropped a piano on his head" can just be funny. You don't have to really think about like, oh God, like that'd be a terrible way to actually kill somebody.
Yeah. And like later when they're like, oh, just like a tune to drop a safe on a guy's head. And he's like, oh, sorry, Eddie. Like, it's just
yeah.
It's right there. It's like, yeah. Oh, fuck. Yeah. Cause it's like, yeah. Cause then you picture like, hang on, it didn't drop on a cartoon's head. It dropped on a real dude. So like, yeah.
Well, but even with like, the alcoholism and stuff, you don't actually see Eddie drink a lot. It's a lot of like empty bottles.
Yeah. And a lot of like, I need a drink too.
Yeah. So it's one of those, it's almost like a horror movie type trope to where it's like, you know, since he's always talking about alcohol and being seen with it and that kind of thing, you imprint and assume that he's constantly drinking, but I don't think he's shown on screen drinking all that much.
He does have a flask on him, right? Like there is an element of that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a lot of like characters talking about him being a drunk as well, you know. Yeah. It's like, oh, didn't you used to be Eddie Valiant? Oh, I thought you changed your name to Jack Daniels, like all that kind of shit. Like there's a lot of people like, and like you said, Mike, like he goes to get a drink, but it's empty. It's like, okay, so it's implied that he's drunk all the booze in the house and all that kind of stuff. So, but I mean, his backstory with his brother it's like genuinely heartbreaking when you've watched that one scene, I think, like where he goes, he's taken the photos and he's got them developed and all this. And he's going through the rest of the photos because it's the trip to Catalina, I think he says, with Dolores, you know, and they're on the beach and like, oh, that's right. Yeah. And then like he goes from this nostalgic joy to like immediate sadness because the very next picture is like with him and his brother. And like he tears up immediately. And then you get that shot where it sort of pans across the desk and all that, and like Teddy, which Eddie and Teddy, that's a tune like team right there. But like his desk has remained like untouched since his death, I'm assuming, and it, you know, the dust and all that sort of stuff. But then you get the newspaper clippings over the desk as well, where like all their sort of Toontown cases, like they save Huey, Dewey, and Louie, and this kind of stuff, there's some more gags about Goofy in there as well, with like cleared of spy charges and that sort of thing. But like, I just wonder, like, Mike, your thoughts on that scene as far as being like a 2-for-1 in that it furthers the plot because you get Eddie back to his office, but then you really get some like serious character development there as well.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think is so deft about this movie is how they do so much world building and exposition, where instead of sitting you down, grabbing you by the shoulders and like explaining the world and explaining the plot, they just show it through these scenes. And I think the scene in the office is one of the best examples of that. And yeah, it's like you were saying, Greg, it's just heartbreaking.
Cause it really gives Eddie an arc in the whole movie because it kind of reaches like two peaks. Cause one of them is he's about to go back into Toontown after so long. And that's where he does sort of pour the booze out. And I guess that's kind of another sort of nod, like we're showing and not telling type of thing. You know, because he has to sober up to go back to the place where like his trauma started, you know. And then you get the joke again though, because you get the cartoon gun and the dum-dum bullets, like that's, you know, I don't know how the Chief Indian bullet plays these days, but I mean it's whatever, it's, you know, it's a cartoon.
You know, it's okay for something to be of its time, but that is one of my favorite things, though. You know, I just love the animation of them jumping into the wheel gun and just, you know, how dynamic it looks. It's one of my favorite sequences in the movie.
It's I like that bit too, because, like, as a side note, as a massive Back to the Future mark, that's the tunnel from part two. Yeah, where with Biff and Marty and the hoverboard and all that. And, I mean, that is a Robert Zemeckis movie. So, obviously, he was like, let's use that tunnel again. But it's funny because in both movies, at one point, Christopher Lloyd is waiting on the other end.
Yeah. Well, and real quick before we lose that thread, I mean, you know, we haven't really touched on it, but this does have a lot of connective tissue with Back to the Future. I mean, you've obviously got Zemeckis, you've got Christopher Lloyd, but you also got that Alan Silvestri score. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, I think when you start hearing that style of score, it's I don't know, like watching it the other night, it just felt like a warm bubble bath. It was just and it invokes a lot of the same nostalgic feeling that watching Back to the Future does. It feels very similar.
You have that Spielberg production as well, like, yeah, you know, Spielberg's influence over the top without being the director as well. So there's a couple of lines that double up from Back to the Future as well pop out too. Like, there's one, the weasels are chasing him and you get that, I'm gonna ram him. It's like, that's the Biff line, or he's gonna ram Marty. And then Christopher Lloyd as well, when he's talking later on, where he's like, you know, there'll be a freeway like as far as the eye can see, like all this kind of shit. Like, that's very Doc Brown, where he's talking about, you know, this was once like all farmland with Peabody and his pines and all that shit. So that's sort of every now and then I hear things like that, and I'm like, oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm. The freeway rant is incredible, by the way. That's just an epic little monologue that he gives. And he's exactly right. Like, that's 100% what all of America just turned into, you know, following that period of time. And then what does Eddie say afterward? Like, he's a lunatic or something like that. Just,
yeah. Yeah, only a toon could come up with a freeway idea or something like
yeah.
that.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and talk about it being subversive too, because, you know, it's like, you know, it kind of washes over you when you're a kid, but when you watch that as an adult, it has a different resonance, because it's like, wait a sec, that's what actually happened.
Mm. Yeah, you get, there is a lot of, I mean, I think that's why the movie holds up, because you set it in the 40s, so it doesn't really become dated as far as like, oh, well, why don't they just get their phone or whatever it is, you know, things like that. You know, like half the Seinfeld episodes now wouldn't be a thing if you set them today, because they would just call people on their cell phone or get on the internet or something like that. But like, I think being that it's sort of the noir feeling and story of the movie, like right from the start, I mean, it's a Disney movie about a murder case with cartoon characters, but you also get like a Chinatown kind of subplot with the conspiracy to remove public transport and make people buy more cars and things like that. So
and that, like that Jared, plot, Greg, that plot element really, I think, resonates today too. Especially here in Phoenix, we're sort of in the middle stages of building out this light rail system. That's the, you know, an above ground train. But back in the day, we had a streetcar, and it was all this lobbying by the auto industry. So, I mean, this is a historic thing. But as people talk more and more about sustainability, everybody's like, well, what happened to these streetcars? You know, why did we have a streetcar that served like the whole urban core of Phoenix, and why is it gone now? But even now, like last year, the city of Phoenix had to fend off like a Koch brothers funded effort to basically shut down expansion of our light rail system. And so to see it, you know, in Roger Rabbit, and to see this, you know, this be a thing that, you know, through the lens of dramatic irony, we understand already happened, in America once, and to see it, you know, really kind of playing out again in real time. It's funny, I guess, how these themes kind of just keep making themselves relevant over and over again.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, well, there's so much to this movie when you start to sort of look into it. But I mean, like Jared, do you like that sort of like film noir kind of style? Like, I feel it kind of made a little resurgence there for a while after Sin City kind of
was a hit. And I do enjoy kind of that film noir stuff. You know, I other than Sin City, I'm having a hard time off the top of my head really naming one, because I don't have the memory you guys do.
Well, I guess you're looking at older stuff, really, like you sort of Casablanca and that kind of thing. But like, there's a your favorite actually, Jared, Mel Gibson.
Fuck that son of a bitch.
He actually did a movie a while ago, Payback, and that's actually kind of like a almost like a film noir type thing. But
oh yeah,
but yeah. So if you can sort of get past the fact that he's in it, nope. Yeah, that is. That's one.
Well, Greg, your guy Ryan Johnson kind of broke into the scene by making this teen film noir called Brick with Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
My guy, yeah.
That's a yeah, your guy.
I like Looper. I like Looper. I didn't mind that. That was all right.
But, yeah. But like yeah, that, the movie Brick one is. I remember right. when I saw Brick in theaters. They handed out like a little like index card sized glossary that kind of told you some of the like old film noir jargon that they were going to use in the movie. Like to heal someone means to follow them, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. All the dames and yeah.
Yeah.
That's a pretty obvious one, but obviously, yeah.
Right.
I think like the noir stuff is, there's a lot more to it than just kind of like the 40s look and stuff. Like usually your noir detective story has like a lot of red herring characters, and like this one's full of them because initially you have RK Maroon, like the cartoon magnet, like he's a red herring. You think like, what's he up to kind of thing. And like, I think he's sort of this weird cross between Walt Disney and Richard Nixon. I don't know. That's the way I see him. It's sort of, it's strange, but he sort of, you know, like you've got that character, obviously like Doom is in and out back and forth. Even like Acme early on, you kind of like, well, what's going on? At the very start, at least, because like what's going on with him and Jessica. And then of course, like, I mean, we won't bury the lead anymore, like Jessica Rabbit, like she is set up as another red herring, but as that typical noir like femme fatale kind of character. So like, I don't know, how do you think Jessica Rabbit holds up these days as a a character?
Sorry, I can't help but chuckle when we talk about holding up and
did anybody see Heidi Klum's Jessica Rabbit costume a few years ago? She's famous for her elaborate Halloween costumes, but she dressed up as Jessica Rabbit.
I didn't know.
Google it at some point. It is absolutely terrifying. It is, it's not like it's not a good Jessica Rabbit costume, but it's like throwing the idea of Jessica Rabbit in your face and saying, hey, 100% of men, is this what you wanted? And it's like, oh God, no. Like,
oh Jesus.
What, right?
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
Good Lord. That is horrifying. That
I was expecting to just see have dream. The dress and a wig, but like, no. Yeah,
oh no. Oh no. That's, and it looks very plasticky. Like, you know, she's got like some kind of makeup application to make her look especially shiny and cartoony.
Oh, she totally did.
Well, yeah, a couple of big plastic bits I can see. But yeah.
Yeah, that's like an entire apparatus. I don't even understand how that works. It's like where like the cables and weight belts and all of that other stuff. That's that's chilling. I could have gone my entire life without seeing that.
It's got a bit of an Eva Marie happening there.
Yes. Oh my God. I understood that reference.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's actually very, I'm glad you brought that up, Tim, because I hadn't seen that before, but like that almost sort of like makes the point of the movie, or not the point of the movie, but the point of the character for the people that are the detractors of like, oh, of course, like the female, like the perfect female have got these, you know, ridiculous massive tits and she's all sex and all this kind of thing. It's like, yeah, but like that's the joke. Like she's a tune, like it's the parody of that kind of idea. Like what would like this character be like and things like that. So like, I just think like today, if the movie came out, the amount of backlash and kind of fake outrage would just be off the charts. But again, it would miss the point like it normally does.
Well, and let's just put this on Front Street. There's no way that this movie would be made today. No way.
No. I mean, some of the more adult stuff as well. I mean, like when Maroon gets killed, like that's pretty brutal as well. Like he's already trapped in the editing machine, and then he gets just sort of shot in the back a couple of times. It's like, oh, okay. Like, as a kid, it's not sort of, it didn't bother me particularly, but like, I could see kids that, you know, but I was what, I would have been, when was it? 88. So I would have been 9. So like, and back then kids, you know, handled a lot more than they do now, I think. But
no, yeah. No. The difference is back then parents handled a lot more than parents do now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think like the fact that this like woman or this toon woman that's in the show and at the ink and paint club that all the, you know, the Marvin Acme guys are there sort of like, oh, look, here she comes, you know, all this kind of stuff. Like, that's kind of the thing. It's like, well, and then for Robert, why would Roger be so upset? It's like, because this is his wife. And like, and I don't know. I think it works in the movie itself. And like, she's like, Jessica is set up as a villain too for most of the movie. You kind of, I think, meant to think like, oh, she's behind this somewhere, because she pops up here and there and runs away when someone's killed. And
you don't understand her motivation through most of it is what happens.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. And she seems to be making trouble where she really has no need to a lot of times as well. Like she turns up to Eddie to Eddie's office, you know, that scene where his pants fall down and this kind of thing. And Dolores turns up but she, like, Jessica doesn't sort of be like, oh no, I'm just going to hire him. She sort of goes along with it as if like, oh yeah, something's going on. Like, she sort of like rolls with it just to fuck with Dolores a bit. So,
well, you know. One thing I do want to point out real quick is, you know, we're talking about Jessica in the club, and I didn't mention this earlier when we were talking about like the visual effects. One thing I noticed when I was watching this is that her dress, they actually adjusted the opacity in the dress so you could see through it, like between her legs. I know that sounded bad, but like the length, like,
right, you know, like when she walks, yeah.
Yeah, when she walks, you could see like the other patrons on the other side of the stage from where you're shooting a little bit. And it just kind of was that gave that sheer feel to something that was clearly animated, but up against this background of live action, which, you know, was another one of those nice, it's a little touch, but it did a lot of work there.
Yeah. Well, her dress is all sparkly in that as well, in that scene as well, where in the nightclub, whereas normally when you see her every other time, she just sort of has the red dress, whereas it's all like lit up and sequiny kind of thing in the like, that's her lounge act dress, I guess, and this is her normal dress. But yeah, I noticed it too the other day when I watched it, which I don't think I'd noticed before. Yeah, the sheer, like the see-through bit of it when she kicks the guy, you know, like, well, not kicks him, but she, you know, flips him back from the stage with her foot. Like, you could see through like the dress around her ankle and stuff like that into the background. So little details like that, I mean, they didn't have to do. It's like the lamp that you were saying before, Mike, but they sort of went over and above to make it seamless.
And it helps it hold up. That's another thing. It helps those little things now, 30 years later, you know, touches that compare well with what occurs now. So it helps it from feeling dated, because if they had just drawn the dress and you couldn't see through it, it would be a little different feel. And just kind of like, okay, they just overlaid it. It wasn't integrated.
Yeah, there's still a lot of stuff that you look at in the movie and think like, shit, like, how did they do that? You know, like, not that in particular, but that's sort of one of those examples of effort that they put in. But I mean, I think like they show Jessica as this, you know, sex symbol character type of thing that every man in the movie is kind of obsessed with almost, or smitten by at least. But I mean, they show her as being capable as well. I mean, she's not sort of just standing around like, oh, help me and all this. Like, she's got her own plans and she's trying to, you know, get to the bottom of things. And ultimately all the stuff with Acme is to try and help Roger's career and all that kind of stuff, because deep down, like, she loves her husband, even though he's a fucking rabbit. But like, but that's what we said before. It's like, well, she says, oh, he makes me laugh. So, but I mean, she has a couple of good lines as well, where, like, Tim, you brought up that I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way. But the one that still makes me laugh is at the end when she's like, I've loved you more than any woman's ever loved a rabbit. Like, that still makes me laugh.
That was, this was before the rabbit vibrator was invented, right? That's a more modern, women have loved rabbits. I mean, I've heard.
Well, it's not, there's also, I guess there's the, Fatal Attraction reference there maybe as well.
Oh, there's the,
rabbit.
That's more like rabbit hate.
Yeah.
The opposite of, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. Like, to me, like having that scene with Jessica and making her debut, like in the, what is it? The Ink and Paint Club, like that also sort of helps set the scene of a lot of the stuff we were talking about before. Like, Tim, you were talking about the symbolism and like there's classism and racism and things like that. Like, the toons in that club, they're all workers. There's no patrons there. So I guess, is that meant to be like another kind of subtle nod to like segregation and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it must be. I haven't even thought about it on that deep of a level, but it's like, yeah, all these things jump out to you. Like, it's all in there, right? Yeah, like you've got the servers, the bouncer, the octopus bartender, even Betty Boop, who shows up as a cocktail waitress.
Yeah.
That's a really memorable scene too. That's an interesting little bit of backstory for Eddie. Whatever little relationship that he and Betty Boop had going on back in the day, like that's pretty cute. Anyway, I like that.
Well, I think. Well, Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well,
I was going to say it adds another level of melancholy to Eddie's story because, like, you know, Betty Boop isn't shown in, like, a favorable light. And it's interesting, like, even though this story takes place in, like, 1947, they're kind of showing that, like, you know, the stuff from, you know, the earlier times is already kind of being passé and out of vogue, you know, being a black and white cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say as well. Like it carries on that theme of progress at any cost and that kind of stuff. Like with the light rail and stuff. Because you do see like Betty when he said when Jessica comes out and Eddie is like, oh, like she's married to Roger Rabbit, you know, like as if like what the fuck. Betty's reaction is like, yeah, what a lucky girl, you know. But there's more to it than that. I think it's because like. Everyone's focused on Jessica, and so like, and Betty is this black and white cartoon that everyone's forgotten about. Whereas 10 yeah. years ago or 20 years ago, like she would have been the one that they were all sort of drooling over. So,
yeah, now yeah. she's relegated to being the cigarette girl.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
with selling actual Camel cigarettes. Product placement.
Well, speaking of Betty Boop popping up there. One of the other parts of the movie that seems to have captured people's imaginations and sort of stuck in their memories were all the other Toon cameos. Like, Tim, you mentioned Yosemite Sam. That's a classic, and we sort of spoke about Dumbo. But I just wanted, Jared, did you have any sort of particular standouts that where you saw, like, a character pop up and be like, hey, it's so-and-so?
Well, I remember Daffy and Donald was a big one to see. That and then I always for some reason remember Porky Pig at the end.
Oh yeah. Yep.
That's all, folks.
Yeah. Well, like the Donald and Daffy thing to me, that's gotta be the highlight, I think, of the cameo / crossovers, just their dueling pianos and stuff like that. That still holds up, I think. It's pretty awesome the way they did it. Like they're still in character and like, you know, Daffy giving Donald shit for his speech impediment, things like that. but yeah, that's all. Basically, I think most people have probably heard the story, but if they haven't, that was the condition that Warner Brothers agreed to loaning their bigger characters like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck to the movie. Which apparently they weren't going to do originally, but Spielberg was the one who sort of made it happen. but the condition was like if Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck are in, sorry, if Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny are in the movie, they have to have equal screen time to Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. So that's why they're together. So you have obviously Donald and Daffy together. And later you have Mickey Mouse with Bugs. And even at the very end, like you said, Jared, with Porky Pig, that's where you have Porky Pig and Tinkerbell at the same time with the little, you know, that's all folks. And then she sort of hits him with the wand. But I don't know, I like the Daffy and Donald scene, but like the Mickey and Bugs one, it's funny because it's while Eddie's sort of falling through Toontown and stuff. But like, I don't know, Mickey Mouse seems very out of place next to Bugs Bunny to me.
And the fact that they didn't really seem to care that much that he was falling, like that's definitely a Bugs thing, but it's not so much a Mickey thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like Mickey, like Bugs has always been a troublemaker and doesn't give a shit. But like Mickey Mouse is a sort of a genuinely good person. Like him to just sort of be like, oh, poor guy, poor fella. It's like, for all you know, like he's dead now. But yeah.
Well, and I was going to say, like, and that kind of illustrates the contrast between the two characters. Like, you know, Daffy Duck and Donald Duck. I mean, there are a couple shared traits, and like, you know, both foul-mouthed, angry ducks.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Mickey Mouse, even in his own featured stuff, is really kind of more of a corporate mascot at this point, rather than an actual fleshed out character, whereas Bugs Bunny is the literal opposite, where he's nothing but character. And so, yeah, it's like that. I mean, the scene plays fine because, you know, you're caught up in the novelty of it, you know, of them being together. But yeah, no, you guys are absolutely right in that there is something kind of like weirdly disingenuous about it, at least in terms of how Mickey behaves in that one.
I think Bugs would just be a bad influence on Mickey. I think you get those two guys together, and Bugs is just going to kind of be like, "Hey, you know, let's get into some trouble here. Like, we don't have to really care about these humans. Like, let's just have some fun."
It's Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
It's Derek and Tim.
Yeah, right.
There you go, Derek and Tim in Toontown. But yeah, I liked seeing some of the characters as well that weren't necessarily one or the other, like Woody Woodpecker shows up.
Yeah.
Droopy as well. Like, that was cool.
Droopy comes back in all those little shorts. He's like, he's always there to antagonize Roger at a pivotal moment in those short cartoons.
Yeah. And I don't know why. It must have just been Bugs and Daffy, because like Tweety Bird has a scene on his own. So that, you know, it's only like a minute, but they didn't sort of have to have him with someone else. So, but even that was cool. Just little, all this, these characters. And not only that, they keep showing up in Toontown, but that like Eddie kind of knows them as well. Because like they said, Roger says, everybody knows when a toon's in trouble, you go to Valiant and Valiant. So like he sort of is aware of who all these people are, as opposed to just being like, oh, that they're the cartoon guys that work in Hollywood and that sort of thing. So,
you know, what's also funny, Greg, about the Bugs and Daffy agreement, about that whole equal screen time thing, is that that's the arrangement that they also have to have to get The Rock into these Fast and Furious movies. Like in Hobbs and Shaw.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he and Jason Statham, like, they have to like land an equal number of punches on each other, and like it's funny if you go back and watch the movie, it's like they both like kiss sexy chicks for the exact same amount of time. Like they both punch Idris Elba an equal number of times in their fight scene. It's like it's mathematical how it's written into the movie.
And then, of course, Vin Diesel demands equal height time. You know, he's got to appear to be an equal height for the equal amount of time. He cannot appear to be shorter for any certain time.
So when you think that bending the laws of physics is the most impressive thing that the Fast and Furious producers have to deal with, actually, it's making sure that everybody achieves an equal level of badassery to fulfill these contracts.
I did like the cameo of the singing sword as well, back in the day, where it was just like, you know, here we go. And then, yeah, Frank Sinatra starts singing away. and Benny, I know he's not a classic character, but Benny the Cab, he's a highlight of the movie for me as well. like we said, the chase scene is great, and I love that joke of like, hey, Roger, what do you call the middle of a song? And they're like, I don't know, a bridge. Like, he just shoots himself. And like, even Benny the cab has the hots for Jessica, like when he sees her later on, which is odd because you think he would have met her before because she's Roger's wife. But anyway.
I thought Benny was great. That's one of my standouts. And Benny the cab getting behind the wheel of another car.
Oh, yeah. He's that's driving amazing.
That was just fantastic.
I love that.
Who's driving? Bear is driving. How can that be?
Yes.
There we go.
Yes.
Back to episode 37.
Thank you for that, because we didn't have our Kevin Smith reference for the episode yet. We were running out of time.
Episode 37. And what's the other one, Tim?
69.
Nice. Well, yeah, I think we're sort of getting to the end, but like, I did want to save it till almost the end because there's a lot to fucking to talk about. But like, Marvin Acme, of course, owns Toontown, and his will and murder and all that is another great noir motif. But you get the setup of the factory early on, where you see all the Toon gadgets and the mallet and like the portable hole, you know, you throw it on the wall and all that sort of stuff. But then we meet, and then we meet Judge Doom with Christopher Lloyd at his like character acting best. There's a lot to unpack here with Doom. So I just wonder, any takers that want to sort of get us started on Doom?
It was great just how like imposing and like creepy he was through the whole thing, like with the glasses and the whole outfit and the gloves and just the way he just kind of moved. Even it was a great portrayal.
Yeah, I mean, as a kid, I never picked it until the end. But when you look back, and especially obviously once you know, but like that's most of it, obviously. But like the clues that he's a Toon, they're all there. So they did sort of. It wasn't just like, oh, we did this out of nowhere. And one of them is that when he never blinks. But that's a pretty subtle thing. But that's apparently what happened. Christopher Lloyd got the script, and as he was reading it, apparently he said to them, "So he's a Toon, right?" And they were like, what? And like, he picked it before he read the rest of the script, because it specified that Doom never blinks. And so he must have just been thinking, like, why doesn't he blink? Which is weird, because like a lot of cartoon characters, like they do blink. But anyway, that sort of is what tipped off. I guess in the old animating style, they probably didn't as much. You know, because
if you go back, there's always moments like, you know, with Disney Plus, we went back and watched Steamboat Willie the other day, which is kind of a trip if you want to go watch that.
that's what comes to mind when you think of Steamboat Willie.
Okay.
He's just drawn that way.
Yeah. But in a that was one of the first cartoons to be synchronized with audio. But you can imagine just like any number of cartoon characters blinking. Every time they blink, it makes a sound like blink. You know,
yeah,
there's a little chime, like there's but cartoon characters, they blink all the time, they just don't have to.
Yeah, so I mean that's a pretty subtle one, but I mean, you look at it, he's got weird skin, he's got oversized teeth, like his clothes cover him pretty much completely, and like his cloak always moves with a little bit of a breeze. And it's like, okay, so he's got a bit of a villain thing happening there. And like you said, Jared, the way he moves, like his mannerisms are very he moves through a scene like from pose to pose. So it's not just like he doesn't just sort of walk somewhere. He walks and turns, or he walks and sort of spins at the last second, things like that, which is very much like which is what animators like to do with cartoons. You have a character move from this pose to that pose as opposed to just standing there or sort of shuffling along. Eddie even says at one point, he says, I don't know who's toonier, you or Doom. And it's like, oh, I'd never noticed before, but watching it again, and I was like, oh, hang on, there you go. There's a new new one that I hadn't picked up on before. And of course, like, he always puts the glove on for the dip. So, which, I mean, really, if it's, what is it, acetone, benzene, and something else, I mean,
Turpentine.
Turpentine. Yeah. It's like, I don't want to stick my hand in that anyway.
I'd wear gloves. Just as a VHS professional, I put on gloves.
Exactly. But he's like super, you know, up to the elbow kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, the dip itself. You want to talk about the straight up brutal murder of the shoe?
Oof. Nightmare fuel. Man, I mean, like, you know, a lot of us like roll tears when Optimus Prime takes a pass or when like those poor bastards on that shuttle get gunned down, but holy shit. And I think what makes the shoe even more horrifying is like the sense of dread. You know, because like, you know, I make all these references to Transformers, but those folks just kind of get lights out really quick. This is like protracted and you get to like feel it. And even like with like, you know, the whimpering and the suffering, and it is just it's terrifying. It's really genuinely horrifying.
And like he doesn't, it's like, OK, from the story point of view, he's the judge. He's hunting down Roger because he thinks he's a murderer. OK. That makes sense. Like, what'd the fucking shoe do? Nothing. He just picked it up and was like, I hate these fucking things.
You know? Yeah, I'm making an example. And that's the thing. Yeah. And it really does illustrate Doom's menace. It's like, this guy is not fucking around.
And I wonder if that's a bit of that second class citizen thing as well, where it's like, oh, they don't need like a trial or anything. It's like, who cares? They're only toons. You can just dip them. Don't worry about it.
Is that what they're? Do they have their own separate legal system where their rights are different, and they don't have rights to a jury trial and all this other stuff? Like one guy can basically just say, "Okay, you're getting completely erased now."
Well, I know Roger at one point when he's trying to get Eddie to help him, he does say like he says, "What is it? You know what it's like," or something like that. He goes, "There's no justice for toons anymore." He does say that, and that's why he said that's why they go to that's why they would always go to Valiant and Valiant, because it's like, you know, they need help. So I guess it's like, well, you know, in Toontown, they probably don't have anything to worry about because they're all there. But once they come out into Hollywood, it's like, well, you know, you get people like that. And you do get the exposition later of how Doom sort of spent a bunch of, what is it, simoleons or whatever they call them.
Simoleons, yeah.
you know, rigged the election and all this kind of shit, which I don't know how you get elected to be a judge. But anyway, yeah, things like that. I just think like the dip itself is such a, like, it's so simple, but it's so clever as well, as to like, oh yeah, I guess you can't really kill a cartoon, because, you know, I'd never sort of thought about it before the movie came out, and as a kid, and I was like, oh yeah, I guess, like, they get shot in the face and anvils on them.
I'll take it all the way back to the beginning of the movie, because they kind of established that when the director is concerned about dropping the refrigerator on Roger over and over, and he's like, I can take it, it's fine. And then, you know, he has the line back, he's more concerned about the refrigerator. But I read that to interpret that, you know, that's we talk about world building, that kind of establishes that this kind of invulnerability, that a certain degree of invulnerability the toons have.
Yeah, I mean, there's no other real way that it seems to kill them, apart from like later with the weasels, but that's sort of a joke. But like, yeah, I don't remember his name, but like Eddie's detective buddy, you know, he's the one that sort of says, oh, remember we could never figure out a way to kill a toon. So like at some point someone's thought about it, because they're policing these toons in Toontown or around the place here and there. So like they have dealt with some shit before, but then it was like, oh, Doom finally found a way to kill a toon, as if like everyone's been trying to, or someone, you know, like someone has wanted to figure this out for a while. It's just that Doom's the one that's done it. And I guess because he is a toon. So, but yeah, like we said, he is right about the freeway though. So that's pretty funny that he gets defeated, but ultimately he is kind of right. The other hint I forgot to mention is that he's a toon is Jessica straight up shoots him in Toontown. He just sort of falls backwards and runs away. Oh, and like, right. You don't sort of ever think like, hang on, he just got shot. And he turns up later and it's like, yeah, he's fine. But yeah, I mean, Jared, you would have been pretty young again, like we said, when you saw this, like, how did that whole sort of like Don't worry about the reveal, but just the actual, like, the assumed death of Doom with the steamroller. Like, how'd that sort of play out for you as a four-year-old or five-year-old?
I remember that wasn't the part that really bothered me. It was the voice afterwards and while he's inflating that I think was like the like the kind of freaky part. Like, I don't think seeing somebody get run over with a steamroller was that crazy to me. That may say a lot more about me than I realize, but it was the voice effect afterwards that was kind of like the, oh man, that's what I remember.
Yeah, the same for me. It was the voice, the eyes popping out, the weird hair at the end.
Yeah.
And Sam said the same thing yesterday when we were watching it. She was like, now I remember why this movie freaked me out as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, being crushed was sort of pretty full on, but it was just kind of like one of those, like, oh, that's a gross thing. You know, as a kid, it wasn't like, I didn't feel it was like horrifying. But the scariest part of the whole thing to me, I think, that stuck with me as a kid was like, yeah, the voice and the eyes and stuff, but not so much. But the way he springs back up, the little stop motion, you know, where he's flattened and he just sort of pops around like this little stop motion thing. Like, it's kind of like a Freddy Krueger type of thing. Like, that's what it reminds me of. Like, that seems like something that like Freddy Krueger would do, where he's sort of, oh, he's been flattened. That's all right. He's popping around. And then, yeah, of course you get the voice as well. But what really sells that whole horror vibe of that moment is Bob Hoskins, because when Doom inflates himself again and he turns his head and you get that full maniacal, like, Christopher Lloyd face, and the eyes, like, Eddie's like absolute outright fear when he sees Doom's eyes lets you know, like, exactly what's going on. Like, he absolutely shits his pants in that moment. And all the whole movie, you've got like brave tough guy Eddie. In that moment, the first thing he does, he fucking runs away. He's like, fuck this, I'm out. And it's only because Doom chases him that he sort of has to keep fighting. Like, his reaction there is just like, I'm running away, fuck this.
Yeah, that was the thing, is that if he hadn't been able to sell things like that with just his acting, it wouldn't have worked so well. His ability to, you know, kind of react to things that he wasn't seeing, like, he probably didn't even have a good storyboard or anything to go off of. It was probably just laid out in the script. For him to be able to react like that, I think gave a lot of credence to what else was going on and kind of helped carry it.
Yeah, I think like that perfect, and I've got to give credit to Christopher Lloyd there as well, because like, he's fucking awesome as well. But like, just the way he turns his head and then you see the red eyes and it's like, remember me, Eddie? And you're like, oh, fuck. Like, like, this is the guy that has traumatized Eddie for years and now he's right here. And then it's like, oh, yeah. And then they're knives. And like you said, and he can seemingly do anything. Like, he's got the anvil. It's played for laughs a bit, but I mean, it's still pretty full on, the anvil. And then he's going to try and kill him with like the big circular saw type thing.
So. Yeah. And I would say that I would submit that when they start putting in those actual cartoon elements, like, say, like the anvils, the knife eyes, and of course the circular buzzsaw, that kind of softens some of the more horrifying stuff we saw earlier, like, you know, Doom being flattened, like you mentioned, Greg, and and even with like the voice and stuff like that, I think it's kind of like subconsciously soothes the viewer a little bit. It's like, oh, okay, well, it's just a big mean cartoon as opposed to something like some terrifying body horror stuff, like we were saying earlier. But because like I remember, like, you know, when he's got the circular saw, I didn't feel as much dread as I did. Like we were just saying, like, you know, with the voice and the actual reveal. I don't know if you guys had a similar experience with that, but yeah, I think just like once he starts having like cartoon hands, it kind of, I believe, I mean, or I would posit that it kind of intentionally takes a little bit of the menace out there to make it just a little less terrifying.
Yeah, because like, I mean, now he's just kind of like another cartoon villain in a way, where it's like, oh, he'll be fine. You know, like he's the Joker, or he's Skeletor or something. You know, like whereas
literally a cartoon villain.
Yeah, whereas before that, it was like, oh fuck, like, you know, and the music and everything. So,
but the reveal, you know, that is the part that scared me the most as a kid. But if you think a little bit more about the buzzsaw and stuff like that, we've established in this world that, you know, your cartoons are going to drop a safe on a guy's head and kill him. You know, that this is, there's some real, like, the kind of stuff that we played for laughs in a cartoon is absolutely a gruesome way to murder a human person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, you're kind of used to that almost in other shows. You know, it's like, oh, he'll be fine, like he'll get away, or, you know, like Batman, like stay tuned to next week, like how will Batman get out of this one, like with Adam West and all that, and you're like, oh, they'll be fine.
Yeah,
you know, you're like, oh, that big thing's gonna drop on him into a pit of acid or whatever it is, it's like, ah, they'll be fine. And I think that's what, yeah, I agree with Mike there. Once that sort of stuff comes out, it just sort of like evens it out a bit more, and it's just back to sort of being a standard kind of fight again. But yeah, I mean, I love the whole battle with Doom. Like even before he's like squished and revealed as a toon, like using the Acme gags as weapons, which were all set up in the earlier scene, like with the murder scene. You know, the mallet especially, and all that. So the glue as well, like causes him to be run over by the steamroller in the first place. And then using the hole to get out of the magnet, like that's pretty cool. I thought that was pretty clever. But yeah, the magnet itself, I mean, not the magnet, the mallet. The mallet itself, like hitting the hose or the faucet or whatever for the dip machine. Like it's good because like most Disney villains, Doom is killed by his own sort of plans in a way.
You're saying is his own plans doomed him in.
Yeah. There you go. He was doomed from the start, Jared. Yeah. And then, of course, you get a total nod to Wizard of Oz as well, obviously, where he's melting away there. So,
Which, again, was also kind of terrifying. And it comes from the way Christopher Lloyd sells it.
Mm. Oh yeah, he's selling it like, oh fuck, like this is not just like, oh no, it's as much as like we're talking about the shoe, sort of the slow, painful kind of thing there, like this is even longer, like it drags for a while, you get a few different angles of it, and like he's just screaming his fucking head off that whole time, and it's like, fuck, like, but you're kind of like, yeah, good, melt, you fuck, you know, like you're not sort of like, oh, the poor shoe. But I do love the little bit at the very end because he's like, oh, I'm melting and all that. And then right at the end, he's just like, oh, no. Like, it's just this sad little, like, yeah.
It's like, pretty funny. Yeah. Well, one thing I want to mention about Christopher Lloyd and Judge Doom before we move on and get ready to close out is that, like, you know, between this role and him as the Klingon captain in Star Trek III: Search for Spock and Back to the Future, I spent a good chunk of my childhood not actually knowing what Christopher Lloyd actually looks like. I just assumed he looked like Doc Brown. So, like, you know, when I would see him later in things, I was like, oh okay.
This weird guy? Yeah. No, he looks like Uncle Fester from the Addams Family. Just kind of bald and pale.
Yeah. I don't know. He looks like a hippie from Camp Nowhere.
Come on, Mud. We're going to hell tonight, Mud.
I do wonder, though, if you guys have heard much of the fan theories and things like that, because, I mean, there was, like, as far as who, you know, they say, like, oh, what was he really? Well, he's not a mouse and all that shit. There is a comic that came out later that does give like the quote unquote like true identity and origin for Doom, but really it's not that good, and it's a bit of a letdown, like everything like that. But for a long time there was a fan theory that if you watch the movie again, it does kind of hold up. I'm just wondering if you guys had heard of that at all, if you're aware of it.
What is he?
the theory that went before they brought out this comic thing, which I guess you can take it or leave it, but the theory was that Doom is the pistol packing possum from, you see that poster in RK Maroon's office a few times. And if you look back at it, like, they show the poster quite early on. And like the possum it's like this possum sort of hanging upside down with a gun, and it looks like Doom. Like, it's dressed exactly like him. It has the hat. It has these sort of maniacal eyes and expressions. And when Maroon is shot, the exact same gun is what comes through. Like, Doom's gun is the same gun that's in the poster. And it even comes through the blinds and is reflected in that poster, like, on top of it and, like, over the top of it. And, like, when Maroon is actually shot, when you see, like, the bullets into his back, the poster is right beside him, so it looks like the possum is shooting him. So, like, it's only a fan theory, but when you kind of add it up and look back at it, you're like, okay, like, if that was the intent, like, that works.
That's pretty good.
I've never heard of it.
But... yeah, but I'm looking at the pictures now, and I mean, you don't quite get those eyes out of that possum, right? Like, he doesn't have the.
I'll send you guys the photo that I've got of it in the.
But he looks the pistol packing possum. He looks kind of like a gangster, like a mobster.
Yeah, kind of. Like, I just think he's got the hat. He's got the, like, the black shirt. And, you know, he's got gloves, but he's a toon. So
yeah.
But, like, if you have a look in the Skype chat.
Oh yeah, you can kind of see it. We'll have to. That does line up pretty well. And what caused the red eyes? Who knows? You know, whatever sent him over the edge, that was causing him to kill the brother.
Because I mean, like, the official, like, version of the comic thing that they brought out was that he is just this toon actor called like fucking Baron von Rotten. It's like, okay, and he used to be in the movies and all that, and he would play the villain, and he could change, like. He was like the Toon of a Thousand Faces and all this kind of shit. And he would play the villain in all these cartoons, and he kind of went crazy and became a real villain. And I'm like, that sucks. like either no explanation or the subtle possum nod. I don't know. There's something. When I see that photo with the sort of the reflection and the gun and all that, it's like, all right, I'm down with that. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know about any of you guys, but I haven't really messed around with any other Roger Rabbit ancillary media, like, you know, like comic books or any of that other stuff. How about you guys?
I haven't either. I only learned of the comic thing because of, like, the pistol packing possum thing. It was like, oh, no, actually they did this. I was like, oh, okay. But I haven't, like, read it.
I played the video game on NES.
Yeah, man. That was good stuff.
That was crazy. Well, I was too young to, like, understand. You would get pulled over by the weasels a lot, and the only way you could escape them was to, like, there would be a joke on the screen, and you had to scroll through all these different punchlines and choose, like the joke, the setup to the joke would be, like, what's worse than raining cats and dogs? And you had to choose from this long list of punchlines, hailing Benny the Cab. And if you got it right in time, then you'd be able to get away from the weasels because they'd be laughing too much.
I do like the weasels. We sort of skipped over them a bit, but yeah, I like that. That's another example of the mix of cartoons and real life, because, like, the weasels, like, they carry real guns. They don't have toon guns. They've got, like, so they've had to, I don't know, float them through the scene and then animate them around it. So and, like, the head weasel says bullshit as well, which was like, oh, okay. He says, cut the bullshit. They're like, all right. Then we've got cartoons swearing. But then it helps, I guess, because they weren't already an established character. It's not like you had, you know, Daffy Duck or something saying it. So, and the running gag, I think, of them, like, one of these days you're going to die laughing. Like, I think that pays off in the best way. Like, I love that whole, like, Eddie does his vaudeville routine and they all just slowly die. Like, that's pretty cool.
I remember that was one of my favorite parts when I was little, was the whole routine, because just that, you know, a little kid, you know, the stuff he's doing that makes them laugh makes you laugh.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember really enjoying that part.
Yeah, and just the, like, the payoff for it. It's like, because once he starts, you know, like, one of these days you're going to die laughing, and you're like, oh, okay. And then you think, all right, is this going to work? Because we've only really seen the dip as the only way to kill a tune. And it's like, well, here's another way. Like, if these idiots can't stop laughing. So,
yeah. And maybe it could be one of those things where the rules are a little different. Like, Roger can get out of the handcuffs, but only when it's funny. You know, like, maybe if they, maybe they die laughing, maybe that's not the same as them being dead permanently, but that's it for them in the scene, right? Like, they can't come back, at least until, you know, until a later time.
Yeah, well, I guess they just, they became like little toon angel things instead. They weren't like, you know, so they were still around. Yeah.
It's funny, though, because it kind of makes me rethink the handcuff scene, because Roger is very earnest when he delivers that line. It's like, only when it was funny, you know, so maybe, maybe speaking very literally, maybe he couldn't physically do it unless it was at a time when it was funny.
Yeah, that's the, like, the weird meta rules that they sort of have to live in. I do like, though, that the one weasel that does actually definitely get killed proper is that head weasel, because he's like, you know, oh, kick you in the nose. He's like, that don't rhyme with walls. No, but this does. It just boots him right in the nuts. And just how he flies, like, from, you know, right up to the top and just splash. You're like, oh, he's fucked. Like, he's proper dead, that one.
Yeah, I did really like seeing the soles fly up, which didn't really make sense if you really think about that. Should have gone the other direction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the last one, the crazy one with the what do you call it? The straitjacket. He's the last one to die, but he's the one that even as like little angel ghost or whatever he is, he's the one that turns the dip thing on again. You know, so, and he still can affect the world even though he's apparently dead. So, bit of Yoda shit going on there. Back to good old Ryan.
Hey, Ryan.
But yeah.
Let it go. Keep moving.
So, yeah, like we said, they never did a sequel to it, which you think they would have, on one hand, being like, it was so successful and like pretty much critically acclaimed by everyone. But then I understand why they never did, because you think like, fuck, I made that movie. Like, it took forever and the drama involved. It's like the South Park guys. Like, they, once Team America came out, they were like, I hope you don't ever want to see another puppet movie, because we're not doing one ever again.
They kind of did do another one when they did Space Jam. To some extent, that was... Right. If Roger Rabbit never happened, they never would have done Space Jam.
Space Jam is not... It's not a... It doesn't hold up that well as a comparison to Roger Rabbit. It's not the kind of technical masterpiece... Like Space Jam is kind of it's having a real moment right now in its cult following. Like, we all watched it for Derek's birthday, except for Derek, who fell asleep.
He passed out.
I'm sorry.
Different.
Yeah. No, he
fell asleep.
He gently fell asleep. He's just a tired boy.
He's gonna change his name to Jack Daniels.
He's gonna change his name to White Claw.
Claw's the law, man. That's awesome.
But back to the sequel thing. I was kind of interested in that. I'd forgotten that Steven Spielberg was a producer on this movie, and I wonder how much getting into animation with Roger Rabbit is what propelled him down the line to do Tiny Toons and Animaniacs, Freakazoid, and all these like incredible, you know, cartoons that in so many ways define my childhood.
100%, I think.
But then part of the sequel or the reason they didn't have a sequel had a lot to do with Spielberg, because one, the sequel that they had planned was a prequel that was going to take place during World War II. And Spielberg, after making Schindler's List, didn't want to do another movie where Nazis were the bad guys.
Yeah.
And then also he had a falling out with Disney because one of the cartoons, I think it was Tummy Trouble, they attached it to Dick Tracy and he had really wanted them to put it on Arachnophobia, which was his movie. Which it's kind of funny to think, like, hey, come see this Roger Rabbit cartoon with Arachnophobia, but that was what he wanted, and I guess he was pretty mad about it.
Jeez. Well, the spiders probably weren't any scarier than Doom, so.
Right.
Well, at least
me, Eddie. Fuck
that. At least then you would have had a Bumblebee and Hot Rod fighting Nazis in World War II.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the Transformers movie I want.
Well, you.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
No, I don't. I really don't.
Don't watch that movie, please.
I'm sorry.
That's my public service announcement today. Please don't go watch Transformers: The Last Knight. No, don't do it.
That
movie.
You can listen to our podcast about it, though, where once again Tim is the only guy that liked a particular movie.
I will.
Oh, yeah.
I am of the opinion that of the Michael Bay Transformers movies, The Last Knight is the second best, which isn't saying very much. But it's a whole separate thing, and that may have been the origin of the Taco Bell comment. No, maybe not.
Mike, you don't understand. Tim really enjoys shitty movies and trying to defend them for how shitty they are and find ways to justify telling people to watch them when nobody really should. That's Tim's gimmick.
I don't know. You have to listen to this other podcast. I can't relitigate Transformers the Last Knight. I think all of my very faint praise for that movie came with a caveat that, like, you still shouldn't watch it.
It's just if you have to watch,
right? If somebody puts a gun to your head and says you have to watch one of Michael Bay's Transformers sequels, like, it wouldn't be the worst one to pick. That was kind of where I was at.
That's fair. I'll grant you that. So now that we're kind of like fishtailing all over the place, one thing I wanted to point out before we kind of peace out, are any of you guys familiar with the book that inspired the movie, you know, Who Censored Roger Rabbit?
I haven't read it, but I'm kind of aware of it, as in, like, I've sort of the some of the changes and how it's very different and things like that. And they're more like comic strip characters as opposed to cartoons.
Exactly. That just kind of blew my mind, because it was stuff that I had kind of forgotten about. But also, one of the things in my research that I had discovered, and I did not remember this, apparently work on this project goes all the way back to around 1983 with animation tests and character designs, where you have I found it on YouTube. It was just like an obscure, like, 3-minute featurette that they tacked onto some ABC Disney show of the week type of thing. And it's they're showing off some of the preliminary animation models, and they have Roger fully animated, voiced by Pee Wee Herman himself, Paul Rubens.
Wow. I knew that he was originally originally one of the people they went to for to voice Roger, but yeah.
Also.
Bill Murray was their first choice for Eddie as well, but they never got a hold of him, or they never knew how to get to him, or something like that. And Bill Murray, like, says he still kicks himself for that, because he would have totally done it. He said
that's how the story goes, is that, yeah, for some reason Bill Murray claims he just didn't get the message. I had also heard that Spielberg was very interested in having Harrison Ford.
Yep.
Okay, that would work. I could see that.
I don't think either of those guys could have quite pulled it off.
No, like not at all.
Bob Hoskins is talking about having to like focus his eyes a certain way, so he's not looking at the chair, he's looking at something in the chair. Like, just like that. That's a level of attention to detail. They put him through mime training. It's wild stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think Harrison Ford could have done all of that stuff, and obviously the grizzled, grumpy detective guy. I don't know how Harrison Ford's doing that vaudeville bit at the end, though.
Also, could they have paired
dancing around and singing? I don't know if he could pull that off. Whereas Bill Murray absolutely could.
Absolutely.
Could they have paired Harrison Ford up with Zora from Blade Runner? Is the other question.
Well, 1988 too would have been earlier for Harrison Ford. He wouldn't have completely become like grumpy, mumbly Harrison Ford either. So
yeah, this is like regarding Henry era Harrison Ford.
deep cuts. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But one thing I did want to mention about that early test footage also, so they kind of wanted to go more like a Rock Hudson route with Eddie Valiant, but they ended up for the stand-in with the animation test with Roger Rabbit, you have a very, 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 very young Joey Pantoliano in it. You got Joey Pants.
Joey Pants as
Eddie Valiant. I gotta find this and shoot you guys the link. It was I just kind of happened to stumble on it on YouTube the other night, and I had never seen it before, never heard of it before. And again, if I'm not mistaken, this goes back to like 1983 or 84 or something like that. You know, years and years before the finished movie would actually see things. Like the model for Jessica Rabbit is still it's very noir femme fatale, as opposed to being as exaggerated as Jessica Rabbit is. So it's like, you know, she just looks like a, you know, narrowed eyed kind of villainess, as opposed to being, you know, this a voluptuous bombshell. Very interesting choice. It's interesting stuff. I'll have to send it your guys' way.
Yeah, that'd be cool. But way back before Joey Pants made it big in the director's cut of Daredevil.
That's right. Him and Coolio.
Him and Coolio, yes.
Do you think there's any hard feelings between Bill Murray and Bob Hoskins on the set of Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties?
I love how all of this is just coming together and all the threads are getting tied up. It all ties back together.
The tangents all merge, you know, back together. But yeah. Any final thoughts? We sort of go around the table, I guess. Like, to me, I think it still holds up. It's still a classic, and that it's still one of the better movies, I think, of the time. Tim, what are your final thoughts?
I'm going to try real hard not to talk about how great Anthony Hopkins is. I think I said everything I wanted to say. It's great. I've been thinking this whole time, I had a Roger Rabbit, like one of the original stuffed animals. He was probably like 18 inches tall. He had like, you know, the overalls and everything. They were made of like corduroy. And this, like, of all the stuffed animals I had when I was a little child, this one like lasted into my teenage years, and I kind of always had him in my bedroom.
Nice.
Yeah.
you've never loved any other toy like you loved that rabbit.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I was begging my parents for a Jessica, but they wouldn't get me one.
Well, after the Heidi Klum thing, I think you might have dodged a bullet there.
Right.
That's still.
I feel like Tim always keeps coming back to Jessica's.
Well, maybe this is where it all started.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that that's why she's Jessica in Rick and Morty, though, as well. I would. That's where I would put my money on why Morty's like sort of, target of his, you know, adorations and things like that is Jessica, because she's like redhead as well.
So. Rick and Morty, which don't forget started off as a Back to the Future cartoon.
Exactly. From Zemeckis.
Yeah.
It all comes together.
Great Scott.
That fucking tunnel with Biff. Charles Fleischer, who was Roger Rabbit, he's in Back to the Future too as well. He's the guy that's like, oh, I would have gone back in time and put some money on the Cubbies. You know that guy? That's him. And he's made up in the old man makeup because he's the guy that repairs Biff's car. Where he's like, $300? It's fucking bullshit. He's like, no, it was horse shit, Biff, and it's all throughout the car. Like, that's him. So, yeah, Zemeckis likes to use the same people. Yeah, obviously, Kathleen Turner Romancing the Stone and all that. So.
We should mention that Charles Fleischer also, he wore the Roger Rabbit costume all around set, even though there was no reason for him to do that.
Yeah. Like,
he was on set doing his voice from the side and always in the suit.
Apparently that was one of the things, like some other production, like he went to, you know, lunch or whatever, and he'd be wearing the suit, and some other production of, you know, like the rumblings around the studio lot and things like that would be like, have you seen that, the Roger Rabbit thing? Like, have you seen the rabbit? Jesus, it's gonna be shit, that movie, like, because they just saw him in the costume.
Oh, that's funny.
So they were like, oh yeah, that's gonna work. But what about you, Jared? What were your sort of final takeaways from Roger Rabbit?
I can see why this one holds up well, and you know why I really enjoyed it as a kid. You know, it's still fun. It doesn't, you know, probably because it was based on a setting in the 40s, it doesn't feel dated. I really thought that the color and what happened with the 4K HDR, whatever they did, it looked fantastic still. Like a lot of that stuff, the transfers aren't looking holding up well, and this did that and looked great. And you know, it's still an enjoyable watch after all these years.
And Mike, since you're our guest, I'll let you close out with your wrap up.
Well, I have a slightly different take in that, like, this is a movie that I loved when I was a kid. You know, saw it in the theater, like I mentioned at the top, and you know, we owned the VHS, you know, and watched the video countless times. Even wore it out in spots as I got older when I heard rumors that if you like freeze frame it at certain spots, you get to, you know, apparently that was a thing on the Laserdisc, but I never had Laserdisc, but apparently there are some frames that if you time it just right on some of the older editions, which have since been cleaned up on DVDs and Blu-rays, but I digress. I watched this movie so much, but like some other things from childhood, when you kind of like set them off to the side, you forget about them. And I'll be honest with you guys, it wasn't really until we started talking about doing this episode that it kind of rekindled that desire to watch it. Like, I mean, I have a DVD from 2003, I think, and you know, maybe watched it once and I was like, oh man, this is great. But then like, I honestly don't know if I've watched it since. So watching it the other night, you know, I talk on my podcast and other shows that I'm on, about transportative experiences. Like, you know, you watch a movie that you watched as a kid and suddenly you're a kid again. And I really did kind of have that experience revisiting Who Framed Roger Rabbit, no question mark. And I had a blast with it. And I don't know when I'm going to watch it again, but I had a lot of fun with it this time, way more actually than I was anticipating. I think I was anticipating watching it with kind of like a critical eye. And then I kind of forgot about that because I was just kind of getting caught up in the adventure. It was a ton of fun.
Yeah, it does. Like we said, it does sort of hold up, I think. And I think anyone going into it to sort of be like, all right, I'm going to pull this movie apart, I think they very much will sort of find themselves like just watching it and being like, oh yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there are people that genuinely don't like the movie, but I don't think it's because of it doesn't hold up or it hasn't, the technical aspects or anything like that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that might be where we can wrap it up and leave it for this episode. But in the meantime, you can follow us all on Twitter, starting with the show at UnfunnyNTangent. I'm at GregT13. Jared is at SuperJew75. Tim is at Tim Agni, and of course over on attackofthedad.com. And Mike, I'll let you plug all your stuff since you've probably got about 10 things.
Oh, I'll be super quick. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and the Facebook is I am at Mike Seibert Radio, and that spelling is S-E-I-B-E-R-T. Just type Mike Seibert with that spelling radio into your Google machine, and you will find my podcast, Mike Seibert Radio, which you can listen to everywhere you listen to Unfunny Nerd Tangent. I talk about stuff and things. I interview independent artists. I may or may not have begun contact with a certain musician that I think Unfunny Nerd Tangent listeners will be familiar with. that's going to be a lot of fun. But I also talk about Transformers and pop culture and the independent arts. Thanks for having me, guys. This was a ton of fun to kick it with y'all.
No, thanks for coming on. And yeah, remember when you're teasing your potential guests, you just have to be like, help me, Flobby One Kenobi. You're my only hope. People will know who you're talking about. So, but yeah, that will do it for this show. Like I said, but all roads lead to At the Steel Cage and thesteelcageshop.com, where of course you can purchase a t-shirt featuring our own redheaded cartoon bombshell, the amazing Mon Milfma. Like Tim says, she's not afraid to dip. So that'll do it. This has been episode 97 of Unfunny Nerd Tangent. My name is Greg, and for Jared, Tim, and Mike, thanks so much for listening. And remember, kids, nice booby trap.
And also remember, kids, disappearing ink will also stain your mom's favorite dress.
Wow. Well, since we're doing extra tags, until next time, wash your hands and make good choices.
Tim, what do you got?
I'm still on dip. I got nothing.